My name is Tony Miller. I'm the Deputy Secretary of Education, and I will be helping to moderate this discussion along with my colleague Pope Ward. First of all, thanks. I know as well as anyone that you all lead busy lives, and so taking the time out of your schedules to spend time with us today is a commitment that you all are making of time and energy, and we really appreciate it. So thank you for that. And it came with a homework assignment, and so I appreciate your thoughts in advance and the work in advance. You know, it's like, can you help us, and can you do homework to help us, was an ask, and we appreciate it. I thought first, let's just do a quick go-around so that everybody can introduce each other, introduce yourself, and kind of who you represent. I'd like us to keep it brief, so that'll give us more time for kind of more content-based discussion. And I'll start. I'm new to government, like some of my colleagues. My background is entirely in the private sector. Started in channel and sales marketing with the automotive division of GM Hughes. 10 years with McKinsey & Company, was a partner, was a COO of a compliance and e-learning software company, and then was an operating partner with a major private equity firm, and then made the transition to government. And in essence, trying to bring a private sector operations management expertise as we think about improving education and helping to really drive education reform in the country. So that's my story, and so I can tell you, government is very different than the private sector, as you would expect, but there's a lot of lessons to be learned. And I think at the crux of it is, how do we think about the customer, right? And how do we think about improving the customer experience so we are, in fact, delivering more value? And frankly, I think we, thinking about it from a technology enablement, we know that technology isn't the answer per se, right? You have to say, what are you using technology to do to enable it? But it is a big lever, just because the technology infrastructure that we're starting with in many cases is below what you might be used to in the private sector. And so that's why, in particular, we think there's some real opportunity, and that's why we've kind of oriented the discussion that way. So,
Mickey. I'm Mickey Drexler. I'm with J. Crew, and basically live, breathe, and work for our customers. They actually, and I think it's the same as government should be. I also work for all the store managers, and I also work for all the people in our distribution centers, and everyone, because I think a CEO really is the ultimate person, or in government, the head of the department is the ultimate person to get things done. I'm anti-bureaucratic. The world's filled with bureaucrats in most companies. Words don't mean much. Actions do. And most people I find who work for with me over the last many years kind of look at you and do what you do, not what you say. Too much lip service to all this stuff. So I'm very cynical about service. I return every customer's call within an hour or two at most. And we test CEOs around America to see if we can learn. And we have a game we call see if you can reach the CEO of a company, even if you're a customer. They forget who they are in most cases. So we personalize everything. And it's Wall Street Journal had an article on snail mail the other day. And I thought it was really good, because everything is not just technology. It's emotion, it's connection, and it's how a person feels about your business. And setting standards, goals, and all that. But treat others as you want to be treated. It's a really simple rule. And it kind of tells you how to get things done.
So my name is Tom Adams. I'm CEO of Rosetta Stone. And at Rosetta Stone, I guess our quick 2 seconds on customer service is that it starts with the product. So we found that when we release bad products, we have lots of customer service issues. Customers are calling and we can't get hold of agents. So the first thing was to up kind of QA. We have a similar sort of customer-oriented culture, because we're obviously accountable to them. And we've introduced compensation-based metrics like Net Promoter Score, mm-hmm. which we found to be extremely powerful in forcing people to really think about the customer experience wherever they are in the organization. So even if you're the CIO in our company, part of your bonus is based on our company Net Promoter Score. And we've also found that the most powerful customer service driver is culture. And we've certainly invested a lot in developing the culture.
I think that's a good point. We're going to come back to that. I think that's one of the key themes we want to probably kick off the conversation.
Good afternoon. I'm Bill Dugan. I'm a national president of the National Federation of Federal Employees, which is the oldest independent union representing federal employees in the United States. We've been in business since 1917, and I'm based out of Washington, D.C. here. When it comes to customer service, basically, I had a 30-year career in the federal government. I worked for USDA, U.S. Forest Service. I'm a forester by trade. And at the end of my my federal career, I went to work for our union. And I've got some good and some bad real-life stories about customer service in the Forest Service that hopefully I'll have an opportunity to share with you as we have some dialogue.
I'm Carl Camden, CEO of Kelly Services. We operate globally, employ and work on behalf of customers, about a million people a year. 150,000 to 200,000 a day globally. For us, one of the key aspects of getting down to customer service has been a realization there is not a single answer in terms of how technology intersects. When your employees run from ages 18 to 80 and they work in 60 different countries, there are those who want to be talked to face to face, those who never want to see another human but want everything to be done on text and everything in between. And for us, embedding multilinearity, multiple approaches to technology so that people can approach it based on what they want, how they wish to communicate, rather than what is most efficient for us. And it was a tough lesson to work my way through the operating officers, but it's been very effective.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Sopelman, and I'm the CEO of Yelp. And for those that might not be familiar with the website, it's a place where anyone is essentially a critic and can join the site, fill out some information about themselves, and start reviewing local businesses. And so, you know, what Yelp shows is the power of visibility and transparency. So when someone walks into a local business, they can talk about that experience and have a platform to share that with the rest of the world. And that really changes the game, changes the landscape such that businesses that provide fantastic customer service thrive on Yelp without necessarily spending a dollar with us. And so it has this Google-esque element to it where the best businesses, the ones that really listen to their customer service at the time, and that changes the game in the local landscape, especially for those businesses out there where maybe the transaction is infrequent with their customer. So if you think about walking into a car dealer or a used car dealer, you're going to transact once every several years. And so there's actually an opportunity to play, you know, hardball to give you a harder time. But because every relationship now can result in a review that lives online, it changes how every business has to provide its service.
I'm Punita Pandey. I'm with a small company called Net Customer. And we actually work with big companies in streamlining their customer service and support. We have focused more on technology, given our location in Silicon Valley. But a lot of the principles we provide in the company apply across the board. Companies small and large, including the government, it's all about service and leveraging technology to streamline service, and technology just ends up being a means to an end, not an end itself.
I'm Debbie Lee, and I'm CEO of BET Networks, and BET Networks is in the media business. We run several cable networks targeted to African Americans and consumers of African American product. We're getting ready to celebrate our 30th anniversary. We've been around 30 years. We're the 14th largest cable network. Just found out the other day. Very proud of that. We just went through an interesting experience. We do primarily cable television through the internet, BET.com, think of in the media business. But we just went through a branding exercise for the past 2 years, where after 28 years of existence, we just said, you know, who are we really and who are we trying to service? And we did a year in depth with my senior team, trying to really define our brand. It used to be anything black, and that's the way we grew for 30 years. But then we found we were getting a lot of criticism from our viewers. We weren't giving them what they wanted. We have a lot of different constituencies, not only our viewers, who we get a report card on every day called Nielsen ratings, but also advertisers, cable operators, politicians, you know, almost any group that has anything to do with the African-American market. So a year or so ago, we sat back and really defined who we are and came up with a different strategy of trying to be inspirational, representing the Black family, representing our consumers, our viewers, in terms of things like that are happening in Haiti and what's happened in New Orleans, really trying to figure out how to give back. And the great news is, in the past year, our ratings have gone up 30%. Our viewers are noticing the difference, and we're really getting great feedback about what we're doing. And we have a better way to decide how we're going to program to our audience and what we really want them to get from us, not just entertainment, but a way to build their dreams and be inspirational and to build their, you know, their qualifications. And, you know, we're not an educational network, but there's a lot we can do at the same time we entertain people. So I think it has a lot to do for how we connect with our audience, and I think the government can use a new brand strategy. I think the president came in with a great brand, and hopefully that will overlay the entire government by the time we're done. 8 years.
Hi, I'm Angie Hicks. I'm the founder of Angie's List. Angie's List is a member-based review site where consumers can review anything local, anything about local service, whether it be home improvement, lawn care, pet care, even healthcare providers. And we've been around for 15 years, so we predate kind of the internet days. So we were a review site before review sites were review sites. So so we've started as a call-in service on a single phone. So so we've kind of had to incorporate technology along the way. And obviously today, you know, we're a web-based business, and we're all about you know, helping consumers find the best service companies in town, giving them the most credible information we can, and helping companies grow their business and really be able to tactically take the feedback they're getting and incorporate it in their business.
Kathleen Merrigan, I'm the Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And I've never really worked in the private sector, I guess the university system. I was a college professor for the last 8 years, but mainly in and around government. And but pushing government, because one of the things I'm known for is organic agriculture, and currently I'm working on a lot of local and regional agriculture. So it's pushing the system in ways that is not always popular.
I'm Seth Harris. I'm the Deputy Secretary of Labor. I am a lawyer and a legal academic. This is my second time through the Labor Department. I was there for 6.5 years during the Clinton administration. The Labor Department is essentially a holding company or a federation of agencies with three principal product lines: workforce investment, workforce development, worker protection, OSHA. Overtime, things like that, and benefits. And so we interact with widely varied groups of workers in a wide variety of ways, and most of them have no idea that there's any relationship between the various ways in which we interact with them. We have a diversity of services and not a lot of good quality interaction with our customers. One of our problems is we have difficulty defining our customers, but even when we interact with them, it is not in a high-touch, high-quality way that leaves them satisfied with the service that they're getting. Often we're dealing with people at the worst points in their lives, but I'm not sure that we help to make that better in a lot of cases. My CIO is here, and I think he would agree with this statement. We are we don't represent ourselves as being at the cutting edge of technology in our relationships with our customers, but we have a lot to learn from all of you, so we're delighted to be here with you.
I'm Dan Weirich from GW Micro. We kind of an unusual type of company. We produce assistive technology. So if someone's blind or visually impaired, they can use our products to either use a PC or note-taking or some other devices. Customer service is extremely important to us because all of our customers are blind. And so helping them use their PCs, helping them do their job, they're using our products to be employed. They're using our products to go to college. And so that becomes a very important part of our business.
And I'm Pope Ward, and I work for Jeff, the Chief Performance Officer, who you saw earlier. And in my previous private sector life, I worked for Jeff, our former CEO, now Chief Performance Officer. So I come from Jeff Town.
Well, thanks. Well, let me just give you a sense of how we're going to spend the time. Well, we have about an hour, right? And so we thought we'd do, first of all, just summarize some of the takeaways from the homework as a frame and as a catalyst to a discussion. It's really meant to inform and to jumpstart it, but not to be restrictive. So that's what we're going to do, and Pope's going to
turn out why we did this.
And so that'll give us the time to engage. What we'd like to do is, if we need to, we'll reserve time at the back end of the hour, because we do want to make sure part of this is really making sure we're engaging. And I know sometimes in the pace of a conversation, you can get down, and there can actually be a couple of tidbits that folks just didn't get a chance to get out because it didn't fit in the flow of discussion. Having been in that dynamic, we're going to leave time at the end to make sure that we can capture other things that folks think we might have not captured up to now before we break.
Do people know what the camera's for?
I'm going to come to that, yep. And so as we go back, like in most breakout sessions, we will be summarizing what were the, you know, one, two, few themes that we think are kind of relevant and compelling to take away. I've asked, and Angie has volunteered, I'm not sure kind of how that works, to help kind of capture those key takeaways on the report to the back. This is, in fact, being streamed, and so the camera is, again, not meant to inhibit, but it is meant to capture the discussion. It's being streamed live on the White House website. And so, again, I hope it won't inhibit any candor. Oh, yes, and yeah, I think suggested, and I know we're all busy, but if we could ask you to either turn down the ringers and or off your BlackBerry cell phones just so it doesn't interrupt the flow of the discussion.
And especially not near the mics. I notice everyone's being good, but they make them buzz.
Okay. So any questions before we jump right in? Okay.
Let me just give you the briefest of overview from the first section of your homework. This was the force ranking exercise that you did. And it was varied across each of them, and that was different than some of the other groups, though some of the others really clustered quite a bit. But two really stood out: the culture of customer service. We'd like to actually start there. And the second, deep understanding of the customer, especially the evolving customer. I guess it shouldn't surprise us that things like hardwiring customer feedback and clear customer service metrics would be really supportive of these two anyway. So I imagine that the discussion will blur, but we'll just use especially these first two as a loose structure to get us going in the session, if that makes sense to you all. That'd make good. And so we can refer back to that if we need, but that's the high level from your course ranking.
I think, Tom, you talked about it kind of at the core. There's a lot of things, and I think Mickey alluded to it also early on. It is about kind of the culture, and it's about your actions, consistent set of things at your organization. So when does that resonate with folks in terms of if you're really going to be customer-centric, it's got to be a whole culture because it's going to manifest itself in both ways, known and unknown. And so is that important, and what are some of the things that you do to nurture that kind of culture?
So maybe if I can just kick it off with, I don't want to pretend that we're perfect. So we're also in a learning mode here, and to learn from everybody here. But I think the company, to begin with, was product-centric, and so we would think about the customer just from a product perspective. But recently, we extended that to include a service where you could actually practice in people. So as we were shifting to that, we sort of recognized, we needed to shift the culture. So we actually did a lot of sessions where we had folks react to, what was the default concept for us as an organization. We landed on create success, and that's something we're brainwashing into everyone in the organization, that their job has to be, what they're working on is not creating success. If you take the Walt Disney Company, their whole concept is create happiness. And so you just simplify it, because part of this is you've got to implement it on, you know, on thousands of people in your organization. So that was the basis of the culture, and then also having employees be able to trade off different parts of the experience quickly and with intuition. So for example, yes, we're trying to be efficient, but it's more important for us to have courtesy and then more important to have safety. And so you know, when you've got a customer on the phone, even though you know it would be better to just end the call and go on to the next one, our folks have been trained, and they're just four different dimensions. I'd be very happy to sort of send you whatever materials we got to, but we kind of, the culture of the customer is something we proactively worked at. We did not sort of wait for it to happen to us.
Yeah, we did. I mean, we did that too. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, our philosophy has always been, if we're collecting reviews on customer service, we better be good at customer service. I mean, it would be an ironic situation if we weren't. But you know, for us, I mean, we, you know, we have a call-in service today. I mean, we're a firm believer that you can actually talk to a person if you need be. I mean, I think technology is wonderful. But there's a certain element of being able to get the help you need the way you want it. You know, sometimes we go along about cost-saving measures of like, let's move everything online. You know, sometimes just having the capability to pick someone, to pick a phone up or shoot an email or whatever it is going to be easiest for you to be able to get the answer you need. And, you know, and if you choose the phone, that you talk to a real person. So in our call center, a real person answers the phone. Like, it's not automated at the beginning. They say, hello, thanks for calling. And get them routed out, so you don't route it out to the right direction, so you don't have to decide. You know, so for us, it's about making sure those customers are taken care of. And if it means, you know, I'm like Mickey. I mean, if I get a call, and you know, even if it is something that obviously someone else could handle in the area, but they called and they asked for me, I'll talk to them. You know, that's just a, you know, that's just a belief we have, and that if they took the time to ask, I should take the time. Take the time to respond. And it's also a great way for me to help understand what's going on in the organization, because sometimes they might be questioning a policy or a way we do things that evolved over time, that after you start thinking about it and get more perspective, you're like, well, why do we do it that way? And maybe we should think about doing it different ways. And it just helps you get insight that you sometimes can miss, especially as the organization gets bigger.
There's a theme that let the customer choose the channel or how they want to interact with you, don't impose it on them, brings up a theme that I saw in a lot of your responses in the homework, which was almost create systems to pressure yourself to be customer-centric. And so, in other words, if you want people to use self-service, you have to provide all the channels and then make self-service better. You know, yeah. So they want to. And I saw lots of ways that you could impose a customer-focused culture by pressuring yourself.
Right, you learn things by having.
You mentioned that, yeah. Your business model, for example.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for us, we actually have the reviews of Yelp on Yelp. So that's one way that we get feedback, is we actually have our users on our site can teach us, and then certainly we monitor that. The other thing that I was thinking about is just the complexity of providing good customer experience requires that your organization everywhere supports customer service. So everyone has to be thinking about it, because there's so many touch points and so many things that go wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to add that you really need employee buy-in. And they have to believe in what your goals are, what your strategy is, and be proud of it. You know, whether it's a brand strategy or whether it's the goals for the company, if it's customer service, it's got to start with them. Because if you have, you know, an organization as large as the government and you don't have employee buy-in, you know, you can set all kind of metrics and all kind of goals. It's just never happened.
The phrase customer service, I think is somewhat. We're a complex organization. I think about working with schools, districts. We do 10,000 substitute teachers a day. The substitute teachers are customers. The teacher who's out sick that day is a customer. The students are a customer. The principal is a gigantic customer. The school district is a customer, and even the departments of ed, the state, all those are customers. And then, as I look at the government, I was thinking about your Department of Labor, and I'm going, you know, like we're all customers in different all different ways, different configurations, and we've increasingly just been talking about a service orientation, which is whether we're dealing, no matter what guise we're dealing with those people, we have a service orientation. And what are the principles of service we believe in? So we say simple things. We only promise what we intend to do. We always do what we promise. And we move on to what are service principles rather than customer service, because it gets to be transactional oriented when you talk about customer service. And by the way, there's a cool marketing appeal to saying, there's a hospital in our city saying that within 29 minutes of checking into the emergency room, you'll see a doctor. That's kind of cool. That's a nice little metric. It's a great marketing thing, but it doesn't define customer service that hospital in the slightest. And I think that we do a disservice to those with whom we interact when we narrow it all the way down.
I'm curious, because this is relevant for us. How many of you have explicit customer, not meant to be narrowly defined, but kind of customer type initiatives within your organization? It's an explicit focus of the organization, right? That is,
it's the only focus. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That and the product. That's it.
Yeah.
You said the product and the service.
If it doesn't affect comp, it doesn't count anyway. It would be my next statement, by the way.
Which I think we're starting to tick off. If you had two organizations and you set the ball rolling, that all of the things being equal, and you looked in on them 5 years later, and one had a customer service culture that is 90th percentile, and one was doing fine. You know, we've ticked off a few of the things. Comp might be one of those things. The customer principles might be one of those things. The organize back from how the customer wants to deal with you, not how you want to impose yourself on the customer. The pressure yourself. To be customer focused by getting things public, both feedback and your own principles. Are there other things that the organization that made it to the 90th percentile would have or be doing, levers they'd be pulling across those 5 years that your average corporation wouldn't, as you look inside?
I think they're also how they handle when things don't go right. Speaks, you know, mountains about how an organization is. So it's not just that you strive to be perfect, it's that you are willing to admit when you made a mistake and you're willing to fix it. I mean, I think you learn a lot more and you get a lot more buy-in from the customer when you've made a mistake and you've made right with it than if you never made a mistake at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Your point, actually, there was a study that was done where they looked at companies, to your point also, and companies that have been more successful because they had a major catastrophe of sorts, you know, like Tylenol, recall. Mm-hmm. If they actually have an event which gets really public and it's negative, how they handle it actually can make them go much further than their competition if they never had that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of funny, you don't want that catastrophe to actually make you successful, but actually how you deal with it says a lot more about the character of the organization and the people than, you know, things will all hunky dory.
The
critical element, I think, is just how do the employees feel about the company? I think you touched on that. Just if they're not happy day to day, like when that customer does have a problem, they might not be feeling like solving it. And so, I mean, just one sort of real life experience I've had is just whenever I fly on one of the newer airlines, and 10 years ago it was JetBlue and now it's Virgin, I always have a great customer experience. Like people are fired up, they're happy to be there, they're thrilled with their job. But when I fly on an older airline, sometimes that's not the case. People seem more, you know, blasé about making sure that I'm satisfied and I have my water and snacks and so forth. So.
You ultimately have to have a group. The companies that I've seen do it well often have a department or a group of individuals charged with actually really understanding the customer. I've had large groups of highly dedicated people desperately trying hard to please the customer, but they don't understand the customer. And I talked in my write-up about when we were trying to do substitute teacher, we were all about checking credentials and getting them paid on time. It came down to the principal said, I just don't want any more 6 o'clock phone calls. We had never done any more phone calls in the morning at 6 o'clock saying I'm going to be sick and not be at school that day. Oh, why did that? That was a that was a drive. And it was a real simple thing to redefine the process. When we were paying temporary employees and working on that, we were driving towards what we thought were good customer service metrics. It turned out that what they really wanted was a two-day turnaround from the time they turned in the non-card to get a check. A whole bunch of the stuff that I was fighting for and advocating for that we thought was doing customer service didn't matter compared to getting the check in their bank account in 48 hours. We assume that we know what the customer wants. We often don't know, and often the customers don't articulate it well. And so having a group that's tasked with really understanding what really ticks them off about the labor dispute process, or what really irks the school districts about trying to get a grant out of the DOE. But I mean, we think we know.
I'm going to come back to that as a major thing. I'm curious, just before that, because I think one of the challenges that we face, right, on the government is who is the customer, right? We have a very complex, I'm curious in terms of if you all have faced that challenge of, are your customers clear? How do you, if they are clear, it seems to, you lose your identity. I heard you saying you had to kind of reinvigorate your brand around a renewed definition of who that customer is. So how have you all dealt with really understanding who your customer is and making sure
you have to identify, and you have to market to that specific group, because you know, in our case, we have end users that are using our products, but they may not have purchased it themselves. And in our case, it would be a state, generally Evoke Rehab or something, purchased the product. And yet we have dealers. You know, most of our business is wholesale, so we're selling to dealers, and they're selling to those states. So really, the dealers are our customers as well. One of the things I wanted to mention, too, is there's a lot of technology companies here. We all do beta testing, and we have customers that help design our own product. And so I think it's real important to let the customer help define what the next upgrade should be. In the case of government, that's a little bit a different metaphor.
Like apps for you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I would say that a big thing for us was that I think we made the student, the customer, first before the teacher. So our entire, 95% of our development dollars and our service dollars are about serving that student. Very little goes to the teacher, and I think that's a difference with companies traditionally that have sort of understood who has control of the money and knowing that they need to sell that. So we found, you know, identifying that child or a soldier or individual and sort of finding out what they want to learn and how do they want to learn, and then doing extensive focus groups. You know, you could do emotional coding to find out whether they are excited and interested and engaged. There are so many technologies out there now to validate whether your software is going to be sticky or not, whether it's user-friendly, whether it's intuitive. And we just keep using more and more of those kind of tools that give us feedback into our development effort.
Customer is anyone that your product or your service will touch. And you know, it really doesn't matter who pays the bill. And like in our case, our clients who actually pay the bill are not the one that we are serving. We are serving their customers. And if we don't do their job right, they won't give good feedback for our customers. And then they won't be happy and won't be paying us. And you know, so it really depends. If you put yourself in the shoe, who am I serving today? And am I doing that as good a job as I can? So in the government context, it really wouldn't matter much who's paying my bill, because nobody really does in a way. Sense. But who am I interacting with today? Am I doing as good a job as I could given all the tools I have? And what can I do to make it better? So they leave with a better impression of having dealt with me than they would otherwise. And you know, we have this challenge all the time of telling our people that treat every interaction that you have as an opportunity to build a relationship, to wow them, even if they're dealing with difficult situations. As you said, you have technology customers and they're very demanding. Usually when they're interacting with us, there's something major, like payroll being down and payrolls are not, paychecks are not going out. So they really need to resolve that issue. But it's also an opportunity to show them that we care. So before you even delve into the technical side of it, hear them out. Figure out what you can do to at least put them at ease. And then figure out the technical part of it and offer a solution. So I think that mindset, which kind of goes back to the culture issue, is really deal with whatever that you are dealing with right now as if it's the most important thing you could do.
We seem to be moving to the customer, by the way. So if there are things that you want to make sure we get on culture, he mentioned the lightning round at the end, so just don't feel antsy if you haven't gotten that.
Carl.
Every, for you all and for us and for many of the other companies here, every individual is a collection of customers. Right, I mean, they are multiple customers, and they only ask to be treated in a unified fashion as a customer occasionally. They're quite happy with the person walking in who's dealing with each of your individual agencies of the government is quite happy dealing with them as an individual agency. They're not asking you to deal with them as in the collective sense of every way they interact with you. And again, when we talk about defining the customer, we're defining an individual in a role, not an individual in all encompassing states, the individual in a role with your agency at that point in time. And we have that same, very much that same situation. And again, so it's understanding that role, what's their expectation in that interaction? Because the expectation they have when they interact with the IRS has zip to do with what they expect they're going to get and what they deal with in a way.
Sorry. 1 in 6 Americans gets food assistance from USDA every day.
Yeah. I mean, but it's just different. They don't have any expectations.
Could I ask you a...
I was just going to point out that part of the problem and the challenge in the federal government is it's really important to remember that the employees of these agencies, in some respects, are also customers. And what I mean by that is a lot of the administrative services that the agencies provide internally, their customers are the employees of those agencies. That's very important. It's also important when you get to the point of talking about how you're going to transform customer service, and you're talking about the use of new technologies and those sorts of things, you could have unintended consequences on the employees in terms of like reorganizing and retooling with new technologies, which might result in better customer service to external customers. But the cost oftentimes is the workforce gets saddled with a lot of administrative type stuff that they really don't have the skills and the tools to do, and really it was not part of their job to begin with. And so you end up with, in some cases, decreased productivity, the decreased output, because those people are having to do this other stuff than what you hired them to do. So I just want to point out that I think that's something that really needs to be taken into account when you start to actually look at how you're going to implement transforming customer service.
I'm Austin Goolsby from the Council of Economic Advisors. I apologize for coming late. They've got us going from group to group. It's a little bit of a change of pace, but I would be interested. We in the government, we have faced for customer service and the customer interface the following difficulty, which you might give us some insights on. Lots of pressure to have an online interface, provide customer service over the internet, more convenient, new technology, better. But in some sense requires just double, the infrastructure has to be doubled because you can't replace the existing. There are still going to be a whole bunch of people that are not online or they're interacting in some other way. And how to deal with, as the technology is changing in the transition period, which can go for years, how do you manage that? Do you in the private sector or in not-for-profits or at any level, do you have any insights that can help us in the government of how to manage this? Because in some sense, the existing folks feel like, wait, we're being shortchanged so that you can do this highbrow new technology thing and you're spending all the money on that. but we have this, you know, big constituency that doesn't use that. And then on the other hand, the people say, you're totally backward, you're totally behind the times. How are you not providing it? Do you have any tensions like that in your organizations?
Retail, bricks and mortar versus online. I mean, it's a whole infrastructure. If you look at the last,
well, you know, I think it's cross. This is all very complicated. I don't think there's any. First of all, it starts with the culture, the passion, the commitment. I think all great companies in the world are companies that are led by a team of people or extraordinarily dedicated, day in and day out, to satisfying a customer and the employee. We don't call them employees. I kind of don't like the name. We call them associates. Because, you know, and I said at the beginning, I work for all our customers, I work for our associates, and I work for the shareholders. Because all of us have the ability, and I'm so cynical about big corporations today, and I know some of you are quite big. I used to run a very big company, now we're much smaller. But the lip service to customer service and the reality are two different things. I interview everyone who comes into headquarters in New York. We have about 600 or 700 people. Everyone from mail service to receptionist. And if they had another job, I say, how often do you see the CEO or even your boss? It's astounding. So, you know, they used to call it management by walking around or whatever. It's astounding how little interaction there is in organizations in America. And in my industry, which is bricks and mortar and online, we are truly selling individuals only. I don't like middle people, so we deal directly. We don't sell anyone but our customers. We, you know, we have our real estate, we have online. But it's astounding how remote so many managements are today to the people that work there. And if you're not connecting to the people that work there, you're not connecting to the customers. That's why we have the game. I tried to reach the CEO of Mercedes North America for 4 months. I was a customer. Now, Mercedes is not a $5 purchase. And I don't expect on a $5 purchase. But I've been on the board of Apple since they went into the retail business. Their service is extraordinary for a $40 billion company. Because Ron Johnson, who runs retail, every single day of his life is in the stores, out there, and cares. So now, if you get to online versus, you know,
how do you balance?
You know, the last 10 years is, you know, every year is like, it takes 10 seconds for a year to go by. So whatever technology we have will pretty much be obsolete. You guys are in the I'm not in the tech, I don't know anything about this stuff. But it'll be obsolete quickly. So I called on this conference, I spoke to Greg, I spoke to?
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know anything about technology. I do know it's critical to the result, but I do know, and I've spent my entire adult life practicing to help people get the respect, along with associates, to get the respect of who they are. So 10 years ago, there was no online.
Yeah.
We have about 30% of our business is online catalog, we call it direct. So we have about $1.6 billion or $1.7 billion in sales this year. So it's a nice sized apparel online business. It's gone from the 7 years ago when I took over the company, I think it was, I don't know if it was 10%, it's almost 30% of our volume is online. Of the 30%, 80% is through, 30% is direct, catalog and online. Now, 80% of all of our business is transacted online of the 30%, and 20 is telephone. And so we're letting the customers direct us. All we can do is figure out where the puck's going on that. So it's hard, especially with technology today. You know, I've seen what's happened, and you guys, again, I'm not a technology guy, I've been watching Apple and all the craziness goes on that whole industry, and God, I hate to be doing it. I mean, clothes get obsolete quickly also.
Yeah.
But so I think you kind of chase the trend. I think anyone who's running a good business is seeing down the road a bit, and I say no rear view mirroring in our company. So, but I think it starts with a passion, figuring it out, taking your best guess.
But when you set that up, are the people that work in the retail stores upset about the online? Are they in some way, do they feel like, hey, wait, this is taking away our business, we're not going to get paid, or how is it set up?
The answer often is yes, but it doesn't matter.
Right.
I see.
Okay, so, I mean, if you look at it, every industry I've been in, you shrink the brick and mortar. So I started with, I got a long stint in banking, and you shrink the branch network down by, as online banking and ATMs are rolling through, the number of branches being shrunk every year, and so we just increase the radius. And now in my business, the more and more that goes online, I used to have 12 branches that covered the greater Detroit area, and now it's 2.
I see.
Okay, and for those who choose not to interact with us online, we have found, I found in banking and now found in temporary staffing, they're willing to drive further to have the experience they wanted to have with the face-to-face communication. And it's not a duplicate in the cost, because the engine that drives the ability to interact with the customer is the same engine you're going to use, whether the person is sitting at their desk looking it up on the PC, or whether it's being accessed via the telephones, or it's all on, on ATM. It's a unified database, unified protocols. But yeah, we have, in the private sector, a difference of much greater flexibility. You can choose to undo 1,200 workers in the retail net, and you can add a 200-person call center in South Dakota or wherever, and it's fine.
Pretty quickly, yeah.
I was going to say, I'm in the content business,
yep.
And we started as a cable TV network, but every time there's been a new technology that allows us to deliver our content in a different way, we have to be on top of that.
Yep.
Whether it's the internet, so we have BET.com, whether it's mobile, we have BET Mobile. We don't care where our viewers or customers get the content, but we want them to get it.
Yeah.
So, but we can't walk away from the television, even though, 10 years ago when everyone thought internet was going to take over the world, we did have employees on the old media television side who didn't like the fact that we were investing in internet. And then we had internet employees who thought they were going to be the next big thing and that, television was the old. But, you saw what happened with internet.
Yeah.
The bubble burst, and it's still around, but it's never going to be as big as television. So we've learned that you can't walk away from the old technology. It's still going to be there. I mean, people still like the experience of leaning back, watching a big screen, but they want to lean forward sometime and watch a computer screen, and if they're traveling, they want to take the mobile, and if they're, on water skis, they want to do something else. So in my direction to my company has always been, every time there's a new technology, we got to stay on top of it, because we don't want another brand to come along and take our audience. And our audience is a trendy audience, and we're going to always be the first adapters. And when something new comes out, they're going to be the first ones there, whether it's ringtones or content or whatever. So you just have to keep growing and keep, emerging with the technology. You got to stay on top of it. I mean, to give you an example, my mom passed away in November. I called Social Security the other day. I could have gone online, but I wanted to talk to a live person to tell them my mom had passed away and ask, what should I do? After a half an hour waiting, I hung up. I was like, okay, I'm not going to talk to a live person today. I'll try it again another day. Maybe next time I'll go online. But, it's never the bricks and mortar, the big TVs, the original. In some industries, it will go away, but in a lot, it's always going
to
be there.
You've got to always have that footage.
And I think you also, you incorporate the folks that are doing doing it the old way in what's going to be the new way. So you pick off low-hanging fruit. So you're saying, we keep track of everything. We're very analytical in our organization. And, what the most common, 10 most common questions are, or the 10 most common things people like to do. Those are the first things that you take online.
Right.
And then you leave the more difficult things, the more complex things for your people that are in-house. And, in fact, they might be the more interesting and rewarding things to do. It's not the things they're doing in their sleep. It's the things they're like, I got to think about this. It's a little more complex. I really helped someone solve an interesting problem today.
Right.
It doesn't mean the 80-year-old woman still wants to call in and do the most simple thing. She should still be able to do that. And they can still take care of those. But what you'll find,
the smaller share of,
you'll just be able to get, a lot of people will adopt the online. We have a call-in service today. We used to be 100% call-in service. Now it's about 10% of our service. But those are the people that are helping us decide what new initiatives and what things are important to the customer to help improve the online.
Just want to share one interesting statistic for all of you as you're advising us, and it perhaps goes to your question as well. At the Department of Agriculture where I work, in this administration, 50% of our employees become retirement eligible. And that's, we're not very different from the rest of the federal government. So we have very much a graying workforce.
Every year?
No, overall. So I have 114,000 employees. Of that number, 50% in these 4 years across the board, they'll become retirement eligible. Before the economic downturn, the Office of Personnel Management had estimated that half of them would actually retire. We know that won't be true because of the economy now, but we have some major personnel shifts going on that present a lot of challenges for us, and I try to get my mind around that, and how do I use this flexibility in innovative ways. But it's a great opportunity.
Can I ask how you listen to the customer, or how you understand the customer? So if Southwest listened from biggest issue to smallest issue to its customers, it would have food on planes, right? And then it wouldn't be the low-cost carrier, right? And so it clearly has some structure or strategy lens through which it listens to customers. Can you all talk about how you filter customer feedback, or how you get to true customer feedback, or how you get to evolving customer feedback faster than your competitors?
Just a great story for you. So our software teaches without translation and without grammar explanation, and that's the sort of revolution of our method. My first thing when I became CEO was I did a customer service, a survey. Top two things people wanted was a dictionary and a grammar book. The very things that contradict the very good things about our world. It's the right thing sometimes to ignore your customer. Right? So you ignore it. Why are they asking for a dictionary? Why are they asking for a grammar book? That's the question. And so you get to a deeper question, why do they say that? And that's where the insight comes, and that's what's driven our innovation. So we made improvements in the content, improvements in the tools, so that they wouldn't feel the need for the dictionary or the grammar book, but we retain the integrity of our method. And in terms of how we get to customer insight, I actually, I'm very impressed by Mickey talking about how he takes all customer calls, because I don't, sort of forbidden to, because that's how I kind of started in the company, but what I do put a lot of emphasis on is semi-annual surveys, which we do in a different way to the way I've seen it done before. So obviously there's people across the company interested in customer success, but what I really focus on is these surveys where customers answer, maybe 150 questions, and out of that there's a statistical analysis, and we really go deep to try to find what are the factors. If you have strong statisticians, they will be able to sort of guide you. I don't know if you're doing that already, but it is totally different than a normal survey. So I understand what moves people, and it is not what is a 9 or a 10, because we correlate that back to the satisfaction.
Question.
So that for me is a unique thing, for us, is that we actually focus on what moves the customer's happiness rather than on what's noise.
That's that customer insight group that we specifically have.
Exactly.
I think this is going to be, I think this may be a takeaway for us, and part of this is basics for us, right? How many people get regular information of some type about the customer interaction?
Weekly.
Some information, be it sales,
hourly.
Service level.
Hourly.
Yep.
I have to can I be a little controversial here?
Please.
It's all bureaucratic. You start reading these surveys. Honestly, you take the calls, and what happens is every one of your associates will then know that their job is, I would not do business with you as a customer if you didn't take my call. Because I would say there's no respect. And we have been trained in America, big bureaucracies. You look at great companies in America. Now, Steve Jobs doesn't take calls either, by the way. But he makes up for it in product. And I think there's two things we're talking about. The product thing, you're right, I agree. I don't listen to customers about
I don't design either, but what colors are right? No one told Apple to do an iPod. No one tells us to do Ruffly blouses 2 years ago. So there's a product and there's a vision. But on customer survey, and I don't listen to the surveys. I had breakfast this morning after a White House meeting with our 10 store people, three of our best salespeople here at the Georgetown Inn or whatever the restaurant is there. I do that. Yesterday I was in Orange County coming back from California. Every minute you're getting feedback, and my job is to punch holes in every soft spot in our company. And CEOs today are hidden. We don't have any walls in our company now. Remember, I worked in a big $14 billion company. There was walls, there was floors, there was this and that. I have a loudspeaker on my phone that goes to 700 people. I talk on it all day about reports, and I want every one of them to feel that I care about them, they care, they know who I am, and I interview everyone. That's 700, so you know, maybe we're not turning them over that much, but it's still fun. But it's, to me, I punch holes. When I started Gap Corporation, they had a customer service department. So I showed them a letter about a complaint, and they said, oh, the customer service department, dig into the government, dig in anywhere. It's a very low bar service in America. It's an extraordinarily low bar. You know, the airlines, you can talk about the airlines all day, but, and it's probably a bad example because it's a horrible, difficult call business. But again, I don't think it's that complicated. I think it's treat others as you want to be treated. Now, I don't know if you like the calls or not, but you know, the guy said to me, I finally got to the CEO of Mercedes North America after 3 months by telling every group I spoke to, I bought Mercedes for 15 years, the guy won't speak to me. And I didn't want to use a connection or whatever. He said, well, if I took your call, he said this to me finally, I would get calls on squeaky cars and on this or that. And I said, you know, I take the risk of taking the 1 out of 100 fake calls. You know, you get someone who's trying to do something. Then the whole company knows not to take calls. I started my career, I worked in a department store at one point. The management, they hated being on the selling floor. They didn't want to talk to anyone. Now, I think differently about this, and I've been running companies for 30 years, and now I find I'm much better at the customer service thing than I've ever been because I'm more comfortable. And I think it's respecting associates and people. And in my industry, the managements of retail, you try to get to a retail person today, and the woman who shop, guys don't shop that much, unfortunately, but, you know, the woman who shop, no, it's hard. Write a letter. Do you get an answer? Anyway. So it's okay on service, and you've got a huge company, Kelly Service. You probably have, you know, all these people.
But you had an interesting point on the customer feedback in your homework and about how to make it accurate by using standard metrics.
So first off, Ed, I mean, your government leadership, whether you take the call or not, whether you do whatever, there is always a detail to go get authentic. I agree to that. I happen to enjoy. I read when I'm on all these other boring calls with lawyers or government people or stuff. I'm going through the blogs, reading everything that's ever been written that day, every time in the last 24 hours. And I'll respond to lots of it. Freaks them out. CEO.
And they tell 100 friends. When you take the call, they tell 100 friends.
I don't care whether you take the calls or not, or whether you do the blogs, or whether you go stand on the street corner and talk to people walking in your office. But establishing some authenticity to the feedback is good because. They do feed. Yeah. But the accuracy of the metrics back to, you know, to the question is, I think, critical in several regards. If you're going to start tying comp to some aspects of service, you better have damn good accurate metrics, or else you spend all the time arguing about the metric rather than focusing on the service.
How do you get that? Because this is not a nexus, right? How do we think about it? How important has it been to have enabling technology to capture that kind of customer information on a regular, consistent, and evolutionary way?
Huge.
Huge.
Everything.
Huge. You can't market, you can't build, you can't do anything. All the data possible has to be captured.
You know, something interesting about the government, you have an advantage that none of us have. You don't have any competition. Right?
It cuts both ways, right?
No, but it's an advantage. You don't have any shareholders. You don't have any quarterly reports. And you're known to be a great bureaucracy. So you can
That's why.
So you can only get better, and you don't have to rush.
Right, the societal trends will self-organize around the government if the government doesn't choose to make itself relevant. I'm watching it happen already. You'll see self-organizing activities that will make chunks of the government increasingly irrelevant because they're not choosing to be relevant. And so, in the absence of competition, we'll generate competition. It always does. An ecological niche never goes unfilled. It will go filled. And so these are the right questions you're asking at the right time because that self-organizing capability is taking place now.
I'm curious in terms of technology and getting this input, right? There, you can imagine there's many types of it. You could say some is customer perception and some is actual customer experience data,
right?
How do you think about, how do you balance those two? And where you are, is one more important than the other? Is it 50-50? Because again, as we think about, wow, is it better for us as we start putting new mechanisms in place to capture information? Should we focus on customer experience first?
Perception is reality.
Okay.
This is a great story. So I was on a panel about healthcare. We started collecting healthcare ratings. And you know, one of the biggest things is doctors don't think that consumers can judge healthcare. I can't judge the quality of the dental cleaning I received. And they use the example of they don't understand why I diagnose that they should use this certain, you know, method for curing Lyme disease, whatever it was. And I was like, well, if they left that office and they didn't understand why you diagnosed and gave the prognosis that you did, then you failed. Because they perceived that they did not get good care. Like, you didn't explain. You might have given them the right care, but you didn't close the entire loop. So, in fact, it is valuable information, you know, that's useful. That's useful, and it's useful for the doctor because, like, okay, the next time I need to make sure they understand why I chose. I'm not going to talk over their head. I need to make sure they understand why I chose the path I chose.
And over a complete purchase cycle, a trick of time, the perceptual scores always align up with the actual data. It just takes a lot of work.
For it to come.
To come.
Sure.
The survey tools that are available these days, you know, it will take a lot of time to actually put together a good survey. I mean, the tools are there to enable the process, but the content of the survey has to be driven by the internal organization as to what it is that we're trying to get to. Mm-hmm. Most people will give you honest answers. Because if you ask them, was this experience positive or negative, right? And if they say negative, it really doesn't matter whether the person was knowledgeable or whether the person knows the texture of the product. The customer says, I had a negative experience. That takes long the organization. Same thing for technology. A lot of the technology companies, and I am guilty of that too, we think a lot more about the products than about the customers who use their product.
They're just smart enough, they buy it the way we design it.
and that really is not a good learning. I would ask if you take that learning from us, from the technology side, saying, hey, products are really the drivers. It's what the customer says about the product and how useful it is in their minds. If it is not, something needs to change.
I think that's great. And I mean, one of our principles is no technology for technology's sake. And I think most companies in our field have failed because they know that the market, the customer, is asking for video. But you may know as an instructional technologist that video does not teach. So you sort of have the restraint of not using that technology. And I think that, I guess what I'm trying to hit is not the balance of sort of being reactive constantly on the customer, but how can you be proactive? How can you be ahead of the market? How can you have the customer insight that is at the end user level, not at the sort of buyer level? And the buyer very often has a very different paradigm of what they think is important. And so jumping all the way to the student and understanding the student and maybe not, you know, making the product exactly the way the teacher would want it, I think is how you can change education, for example.
But here's a
you guys wrote the questions. Just, you know, they explore, you know, how do we make technology more useful
for what?
You know, like, this is like so 1950s. It's like, what is the, I would have, you know, as an example, I would have expected to see the government really sucks at A, B, and C. What technology tools are out there? What orientations do you guys have? What can you bring to us that'll help us really dramatically improve customer service in these areas? So even the way that you all were approaching the questions is much more kind of what I view as this product or tech orientation as sure. opposed to the service division.
Something that jumped to my mind too is training your personnel, I think, would be very critical because you can implement new technology, but people need to know how to use it, how to make use of it, rather than just throwing product out there. So if they can help their customers by using the technology, but they have to have the training in order to do it.
It's one thing I just want to
verify.
I want to test if I've got it. Because but maybe not so subtle. One thing I'm hearing is there's the customer experience, customer service, how they're experiencing it, and then there's the what does the customer want from a product, services. And I'm hearing it's you should think about those somewhat differently. Sometimes you should listen to what the customer experience is at the top, be sensitive, and understand that both perception and reality. But that's not immediately. And everything the customer says they want, you need to very much interpret that. Because what I'm hearing you saying is, ultimately what the customer wants, they may not be as direct with in the example
that you're
in
the product. I'm saying in product.
The way you're building a great product, as we know from Steve Jobs, is it can really be in product form. And so you can listen to their frustrations, but they might be leading you down the wrong path. And you, as the expert in the area, should be one that assembles the pieces.
Was a good story. It wasn't that they wanted a meeting, got it, don't want to give it to them, but I really need to understand why they were asking for it, because under our model, they shouldn't have been asking for it. That's kind of, that's smart. That's where the cleverness comes. Rather than saying, fine, then when you start planning into your capital, we'll give them a right.
Yeah, I guess just before we do a go around, I'm just the one last thing I'm going to build on, and your point, I think, and your point, which is back to the culture and how, engaging your whole employee workforce to be more customer centric, right? So if that's the goal, and we say it's important, tone starts at the top, you're going to get information, use technology, right, to get information, but how do you make it transcend the entire organization, right? How do you actually, and I guess it would be especially if you have any ideas where they weren't already, right? If you could think about organizations or parts of your organizations that weren't already super customer centric, how did you become more customer? Because that's our challenge, right? We have different customers. You know, we define customers at the state level, right? Or it's a university, but what about the student who's actually receiving financial aid? Well, if I'm trying to shift a large part of the organization to think about the customer differently, what has been your experience in doing that?
One of the large companies, so one of the things that we talk about, the feedback a lot, and if you have an easy, I mean, it need not be very expensive and very elaborate system, but if you have a quick way of capturing feedback from the end users, whoever they may be, and making sure that your compensation in some form is tied across the board in the agency, top to bottom, not just the person who handled that particular student or that retiree, with the transaction, but starting with the secretary, to secretary, down to the service person, that feedback is important to us, and if the end user didn't have a good experience with us, something would need to change. So the bonus could be tied top down to that feedback, and then of course implementing right philosophy to make sure that the feedback comes back positive will become sort of driven by the organization and not technology per se. They will ask you for tools because they don't have that customer.
Can I just pick up on a quick feedback point? This is, as we've been talking about how we go after this problem in my organization, that's one of the critical points because unlike most of your organizations, it's often the case in my business that the ultimate answer, the end product, is an answer that's going to make the customer unhappy. No, you can't have those benefits. No, the law was not violated, so you don't get that big paycheck you were expecting. And so the challenge for us is to disaggregate the ultimate result for the customer or the worker that we're serving in that particular case from the experience they have in dealing with our employees. Our employees, because they're often dealing with people, as I said before, in very difficult circumstances, have developed something of a calloused attitude in dealing with their calls, but if we want them to understand that people can have a good experience, and many of them do, let me just say, they show an amazing amount of patience in difficult circumstances. But how do we give people a good experience even when the end result is going to be a no?
Just to one minor point, actually. This is a correlation to the technology company where you distinguish between the product and the service. So there are surveys that will ask you, are you happy with the product, which could be in this case, are you happy whether you got the loan or the financial aid you were expecting, versus were you happy with this interaction you had with us, with our website, with our phone agent, with answering the turnaround time on your negative response. And if you separate out the two, you would sift out, you know, the actual laws or the constraints of the government versus how they come across to this person who's dealing with them.
I'd like to talk with you more about that later on.
I think the challenge for government is, I don't think the government and the agencies have done a very good job of clearly defining within their mission the customer service as part of the mission.
Right.
And that service is going to vary from agency to agency depending on the nature of the work that they do. I think another thing, in order to really engage the employees of the agency in customer service, they need to be able to clearly understand how what their individual job is contributes to that overall expectation of customer service. So if I'm a, how does the work of a secretary in an office contribute to customer service in an agency? How does the work of the budget person contribute to that? How does the work of the personnelist? How does the work of the scientist? And I think once people get an understanding of what it is about their job and the functions and the duties that they perform, how that contributes to the overall accomplishment of the mission, people can relate to that and people will come together to help make that agency successful. The problem that we have now is people only have a good understanding of what the expectation is for their individual job, and I'm rated and compensated on whether I do a good job or not, yeah, irregardless, or whether that even contributes to accomplishing the overall mission. So there's no connectivity there, and I think that's what's missing, and that's what needs to be put in place.
Okay. Well said. I think the other challenge is, and the difference in the private sector, it's easier to tie because there's a consequence. It's called market share, revenue. There's a consequence if the organization as a whole doesn't deliver against customer needs. When you have a monopoly as a government service provider, it's harder to make that consequence a reality, right? So you can say, no, but if you don't do this, then we just have poor customer service.
But there can also be competition across departments in the government.
That's,
I mean, you know, there's
create a sense of
Just because you know I control labor and you control agriculture doesn't mean that kind of there are common themes of customer service that can be measured across departments. And you know, we're a very firm believer, and there's complete transparency. I mean, employees are ranked. You know, here's how you did this month, and, you know, everyone wins. You know, you accomplish the goals, you win. I mean, there's compensation tied to it. You know, you've got to be able to set the metrics that you want to achieve for. You're not always going to get those metrics right when you set them out in the first place. I mean, we have in our frontline employees, I mean, we record calls, and, you know, the manager listens to them every week and gives feedback. I mean, there's a feedback loop. Because I'm going to record them, so you might think I might listen to them, but we do listen to them, and here's your feedback. And that exercise for the manager becomes an exercise in what things they don't have right and what we're measuring. Because you can tell when listening to a phone call whether, you know, the consumer perceived that, you know, that the same way you thought it should be. You know, whether it was, you know, was this the right thing we should be measuring? And then they can make iterations on that. But we're very transparent in creating, you know, create competition amongst the people sitting there taking the calls. I mean, because it just became, you know, it becomes a game more that way than just a gotta answer the call.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A couple of comments on this, and then if there's anything else we haven't talked about, give folks just a couple of minutes to raise it.
An enormous challenge, much bigger than any of us.
That's why we're here.
Because your mission,
we think that too, by the way.
Your mission has so many dimensions. And I think that, you know, I haven't really thought through how you would implement what we did within your environment. But what we did was we sort of asked the employees, what do you think the mission of the company is? What's our purpose? And you get input from everybody. And you would, our organization's got 1,600 employees. You would try to meet about half of those at least.
and you'd have meetings with about 60 people. And it's kind of town hall, and I just listen, I write, and you get all these ideas about not just the mission, but the values. It's a kind of data dump onto you as the leader, and then you've got to play it back in a way that's true to what they said. But I think that the employees, the associates or government employees, will know what they're there for. But if you just have them define, because I think that I've tried the top down on different initiatives, it is extremely hard to push through any sort of directive down, especially when it's behavior related. It really needs to just come up through them.
Okay, so you guys just don't have tools.
Yep.
I mean, it's not just sitting here working my way through. I can tie a third to half a comp to the stuff you guys need. I can give employees the ability to self-organize and to try new adventures. You guys can't. I can fire a significant number of people or restructure and shift organizational forms with great rapidity to hit the changes. You all can. I can use massively transparent data to shame the underperforming groups. I don't know that you all can do that, but that's
by the way.
Praise.
You know
right?
What, though? Can I just say, I'll just.
That works really well.
I won't speak for Tony or Kathleen, but three of those four things that are perceived to be true about the government that you just described, Carl, are not true. The only thing that we can't do, and I don't think we should do, is massive dislocations of large numbers of workers. We can fire people who are bad performers if we have these systems and the courage to actually grade people based on how they're performing. But everything else you described, we actually can do, including using transparent information. Actually, the biggest barrier that we have is a little item called the Paperwork Reduction Act, which makes collecting data from our customers extremely difficult. And the idea is to reduce the amount of burden that we put on our customers and including the business community. The perception is that if we ask you a question that we're making your life so difficult that we shouldn't be, this was Congress's judgment some number of years ago, that we're interfering with the way you do business and therefore you can't help us to fix the way we do business. But we have far more flexibility and control than even we often are willing to acknowledge. That's what my HR people tell me that all the time. there are some barriers and it just requires a little bit more work. But a good bit of what you've described here, the data feedback being the hardest, by the way, we could do and should be doing. The place where we have the other biggest problem, frankly, is in getting the tools. That you're describing, not just the data tools, but the technological tools. We're not especially good at technology procurement, and things move a lot slower for us for a whole bunch of very, very good reasons that you want your government to procure in a way that's very, very, very careful. As a consequence of that, what we were describing, which is that technology moves very quickly, well, for us, that means we're always going to be some number of steps behind the curve. So, but I think we can actually do a good bit of what you're describing without violating any of the rules. And let me just say, if we work well with our union partners, which frankly we do in some cases and don't do so well in other cases, most anything is possible. Almost anything is possible if they're willing to work with us on it and if we can sell them on the fact that their lives will be better. I'll just say one other thing about that. I'm sorry to be filibustering. But I'm really lucky to work in an agency where the people we work with happen to share the values of this administration and share the values of their organization. They want to be effective. They really care about the people that they're serving. So they want our help to do better. And when we get in their way, they're frustrated and get unhappy with their jobs, and they do a bad job because we've made it hard for them to do a good job. So I don't think, I think what we're describing about a focus on the customer is also something that's going to serve our employees very well, at least in my case.
Last comment.
You asked a question, yep. I think, a while ago about how do you communicate to the employees and associates? And it sounds like you're on a mission now, a new mission. So my first question, then I just want to say what I think just mm-hmm. briefly, is does everyone know what the mission is in your departments that you're having this meeting? So that's, but you know, you mentioned town hall. I mean, when I get new to a company, say, you know, there's a town hall. I used to do it weekly. Now I don't. It's monthly. There's conference calls with every store manager, department manager weekly. Now it's bi-weekly, because as the business turns and the culture gets embedded, you don't need to do the same thing. But you are on a 24/7 mission, emails, voicemails, and you just got to keep singing this. It's focus, focus, focus. and you are on a mission. So I think communication from real life people, voice, email, town halls, you said you do. We do a town hall now, not as often, but everything was weekly. And it became, I look at myself as a teacher, I've been doing this a long time, and then of course you have turnover, so you're constantly having to tell people what the mission is and sharing information back and forth. But I think you have to put some steps in so you become very visible, touchy-feely management, and I guess you can do, I don't know if you do conference calls, but we have stores, you know, we have Crew Cuts, Madewell, J. Crew and factory stores, and now the team presidents run the calls bi-weekly, but I used to do it myself personally every week because you are out there trying to change thinking that's been so embedded. And so I just think those are practical things that are really important.
And stories and heroes. Mm-hmm. Right, so you got to make it. Communication of a culture is very often the banner. You can define it in grand state. So we had we have a value experiment, judiciously grow intelligently. We tell the story of how we had some lunatic who thought we could sell the product in a kiosk, and nobody believed and tried it and showed he could make money. So, you know, you sort of make it come alive. You have a hero. I don't want to underestimate that part of playing it back and making it real.
Well, I appreciate it. And I'm sorry, the good news is we were hoping this would be an engaging enough dialogue that both would be engaging for you and engaging and valuable for us, and I think it very much has been. I do unfortunately think we got brought to a close because we're going to transition back to the larger form now. And I think the other part of it is was actually allowing you all as peers enough time to start connect and so hopefully by cutting it short now we can do that.
Can I just ask a question, Tony? Do we have everybody's contact info?
Yes.
Because there are a bunch of, I'd like to follow up with almost everybody at the table. Except Kathleen and I are going to follow up all the time, but I'd love to follow up with folks at the table.
We'll hear more from Jeff about what happens next. Part of that is creating some of those webs of interaction.
That's great.
Because what we really, I think, what the president said at the opening remarks, I think we are trying to figure out how best to operationalize. This was meant to be a beginning of a dialogue, right? There is a lot, and we need, in fact, to learn a lot from business, private sector, in terms of how can we take some of these practices and experiences and apply them in the context, very unique with all its challenges, but still, that's kind of why we're here. And so we look forward to seeing this and want to thank you for what's been a good session.
Thank you.
Thank you.